Okay. This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Blair Wilkinson, recorded on March 14th, 2014, at Janelle's house. Interviewed by Janelle Jazerski. Captain Wilkinson, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Oh, of course, yes.
All right. We shall start. So we'll play this one. Start with some background questions.
Okay.
So, where were you born?
Vancouver.
And what did your parents do for a living?
Well, my father was had a trucking business, and he was also a gambler and an interesting guy.
What was your educational background before
you
enlisted?
Well, when I finished high school, I went on and did first year and ended up, I was playing soccer for a semi-professional team that hired people to work in their sales office. It was a furnace manufacturer. Anyway. And after a while, I thought I'd better go see what I was suited for, so I went through a bunch of testing and so on and so forth. And they said I should go to law school. So I didn't feel like that, and I always wanted to fly, so I decided to go flying. I was 21.
There you go. So I guess that's your reasons for enlisting?
I wanted to fly, and perhaps much like, what's his name?
Oh, Harry.
Harry, okay. Anyway. So that's my story. I wanted to fly, and the next question has to do with training experience. And I'm not sure that it certainly was a totally different world. I was 21 in 1957. I went down for selection unit, and they took you through a... This was in London, Ontario, and you're there for a two-week selection process, which was your ability to, and I didn't realize this, to be either a pilot or, in those days, it was an observer. And they were the two flying trades. And whatever the Air Force needed at the time was what they made you take. But you went through a series of tests. And the Air Force... could teach you to fly in a certain amount of time, or they didn't want you. You had to have certain abilities. And in the selection, you went through intelligence tests and whatnot and so forth. And in any event, I was chosen, it turned out, as to be an observer, which you would call a navigator now. But so I wasn't too pleased about that, but they said you flew, so I thought it was the same thing as being a pilot, but it wasn't. And so... My training experience, I went through Centralia for 12 weeks, Centralia, Ontario, which was the basic get to know the Air Force, and you learn to march and all that sort of stuff. And then I went on to Winnipeg to Nav School, and then went on to, they wanted a whole bunch of radio officers, so I ended up, as we all were, selected for radio officers, because Maritime Air Command was expanding, and they were part of NATO and so on, and a huge amount of us went through that process. That took about I think I arrived in Winnipeg in May, and a year later we're off to an OTU, Operational Training Unit, which was Maritime Air Command in Summerside, Prince Edward Island. We got our wings in Winnipeg. And I did roughly 10 years in Maritime Air Command. And if you want to talk about that, that's fine. It's something that you may not have much understanding the process of finding submarines from the air is concerned. Are you interested in that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, submarines, I spent a week on an American submarine once because we were doing what was known as a sub-X. And the submarine was wondering what the airplane was trying to do to find them, so I would tell the CO of the ship, what was going on. We stayed in water and so on and so forth. Originally, submarines had to come up and go on the surface and charge their batteries. But during the war sometime, the Germans came up with a snorkel, which allowed them to be at periscope depth and suck air into so they could breathe and run their engines and so on. So the advent before that was you essentially found a submarine by listening to its propeller cavitations. Are you familiar with that? When a propeller goes around, it at a certain speed, it will, the air will, there'll become a vacuum, and then it'll pop, and you get the, you can count the turns of the propeller going around through these cavitations. And the Navy started to use sonar, which is sending sound out and getting an echo back, but we didn't have that in the Air Force.
Were those unique to the submarines? Those
cavitations? No, you get an inane propeller. Propellers are designed in certain ways, and so on and so forth. And later on, I'm speaking about now, when I went through the OTU in 1958, the Maritime Air Command OTU, there were cavitations then on the propellers. They got quieter later. But in the meantime, a lot of other things were coming up, and you would normally find a submarine through its snorkel or its mast sticking up through radar, and you'd get a reflection, and then you'd go. In the Second World War, more submarines were sunk by airplanes than there were by ships, because the submarines would always know where the ships were, but never knew where the airplanes were. Anyway, then they went on to develop a tracking system called MAD, which is magnetic anomaly detection. You could sense the submarine's magnetic field. And they went on to what was known as JULI, which was dropping a sonoboy. Do you know what a sonoboy is?
I do not.
Okay, a sonoboy is a cylindrical object about so tall and so round. And you could drop in the water, and it dropped a hydrophone down. And you could listen to whatever was going on. And one of the techniques was to drop a small bomb in JULI beside it, and it went out, hit the submarine, the sound came back, and you could get a range on how far the submarine was. That was a tracking device. Another location device was something called SOSUS. SOSUS was a sound surveillance system which was up and down the west and east coasts, and in the Iceland-Faroe gaps, that would detect the sound of the submarines coming, of the Russian submarines coming through. And the airplane got a system of a similar system, and we could do the same thing. And it worked very well. And we were very aware of all the movements of the Russian submarines throughout the world through these ground stations. And then the aircraft would go out and track them using its system. So I was Maritime Air Command. So I went to 407 Squadron, which was a COMOX, for my first squadron. I went back to the OTU instruct, and then I went to the Maritime Warfare School, which was in Halifax, which was a combination of, it was a school where the Navy and the Air Force learned to cooperate together to look for submarines. And I taught there for a couple of years. And then, lo and behold, the Air Force, in its wisdom, the selection, well, for instance, I came in on short service commission, which was 6 years, okay? And sometime in the third or fourth year, you were up for permanent commission. They were very hard to get. And so we had huge amounts of pilots. They were all released. I got a permanent commission, but I was the only one in the command that year. That was how tough it was. And so pilots went flying for airlines, and all of a sudden pilots left the Air Force and went flying with the airlines because they were expanding in a huge manner. And then they said to us guys, hey, would you like to do pilot training? And I said, sure. And I was 30 or whatever, and I went off to pilot training. So that was another part of my life, was learning to be a pilot, which was flying chipmunks. You know what chipmunks are?
Yeah.
Everybody starts on chipmunks. And in here, I can show you a picture of one if you want.
Just gotta close this face.
There's the Tudors. You're familiar with the formation guys.
Yes.
Okay, that
was
the jet trainer I trained on.
Oh, okay.
And, there's a helicopter. But in here, I'll find a picture of a chipmunk. And it's a single-engine training aircraft. And there's so many pictures in here that's hard to see. But if you're it, they're always yellow. And anyway, I'll find one later.
Okay.
Okay. And but when I first got to COMOX, and in fact at the OTU, they were still flying Lancasters, which is, there's a picture of one there. in Maritime Air Command. And then as I got to Comox, we started to move over to what was known as Neptunes, which are P-2B7's wonderful airplane, and finally it was replaced by the Argus. So I went through pilot training anyway on Chipmunks at Camp Borden. I went to Gimli, Manitoba for the jet training. Then I went to multi-engine training at Portage of Prairie. And then I went to, got my pilot wings and went off flying, whatever. First position in the RCA was at 407 Squadron Comox as a radio officer. And I was there for 4 years, instructing at the Maritime OTU, training people for 4 years, and then on to Maritime Warfare School in Halifax. Mm-hmm. So that was what happened to me. A lot of constructing in those times, because on the squadron I also, we had a training group that, training crew that would go train the other guys, and I got involved in that. So, but the biggest deal that we did probably were sub-Xs. We had no submarines. We had to utilize training with the American submarines. And we actually flew our Neptunes to Hawaii, which was quite a thing in 1960. And we couldn't get to Hawaii directly from Comox. We had to fly it because the latitude of Hawaii is about the latitude, let's say, of Los Angeles. We flew to San Francisco and then flew direct across. It was 13 hours and 45 minutes in the Neptune, to give you an idea. It was a wonderful experience, actually, if you want me to tell you about going to Hawaii. It was June, actually, so it was the summer, or at least just before the summer. We were there for 3 weeks, and we had flown in order to navigate by the stars. That was the only way. We had left San Francisco at night, and arrived in the afternoon 13 hours later, or 14 hours later, at the base in, just outside of Honolulu. And we changed and showered and stuff. And here I arrived at the mess, their mess, which had pools, seats around a pool. There was Hawaiian music, women dancing, hula. And it was just a great experience.
What were you doing?
Well, I was a sub-X. We were there to train ourselves on locating submarines, and also to have the U.S. Navy get used to being shadowed by aircraft and what they were doing and what they could then do to avoid us. And so that was what it was all about.
Okay.
Yeah. We were there for 3 weeks and just had a good time. Essentially, we would fly out of Comox, what we called foreign greens, looking for submarines, but there was nothing going on really, and they were boring, and so we did a lot of training and so on and so forth. Do you know what a Neptune looks like? Well, I was at a mess dinner at 442. See if a Comox, if a Neptune's on here, it should be. The rotten beggars thing going on here. There's a picture one here. They came in two colors. They all came in blue.
Okay, yes.
You've seen this? And these both have jet engines. The first ones I saw didn't have jet engines. That was to assist them to get up to roughly 325 knots, where you cruised at 180 usually, so you could zip in on somebody and the pilots set up, of course. That was the later coloring of them. And the Argus replaced that, if you're familiar with the Argus. You may not be, of course.
I know of the Argus.
There's a chipmunk.
Oh, perfect.
And you sat in the front, the instructor in the back, and away you went. And you soloed it 12 hours, and off you went. So, that's the Maritime Command. Maritime Air Command was, you worked quite a bit with the Navy. And the Navy has its own way of doing things. The Air Force was much more open and not as regimented, if that's the right word, as the Navy. So the Air Force was good. Did I work with many women? There were very few women. There were no women flying except nurses would come to search and rescue. And I happened to have a chance to go to where the helicopter training was. They also had expediters, L-19s, helicopters, and T-33s. And I was allowed to fly those. And I got the helicopter training school. And then I went off because I was so tired of... In Maritime Air Command, you fly through a lot of cloud. You're always in cloud, and it's boring as hell. So search and rescue seemed like a good thing, so I volunteered for helicopter training. And that's how I got to search and rescue.
There you go.
Now, search and rescue was... The Air Force was obliged to look for missing aircraft. That was its task. The RCMP looked for missing people. Mm-hmm. Nobody really did. Ambulances did hospital stuff. The Air Force didn't have to do that. And the Marine search and rescue was supposed to be done by the Coast Guard. Well, the Coast Guard had no aircraft when I was involved in search and rescue, or very few. And the RCMP had no way of finding people. And there was no setup like there is now of airplanes or helicopters taking very sick people to a hospital and so forth. So we did all those things. And after I was at Rivers, Manitoba, doing, after getting pilot's wings and doing the helicopter course, I asked to go to search and rescue. And lo and behold, I thought I might go to Comox, but I went to PEI, to Summerside, which was the rescue, East Coast rescue station at that time. We were flying Labrador helicopters, and there's a picture of one there. They would carry 24 people.
That looks really similar to the Cormorants.
Well, this came out in the 60s. It's a twin engine helicopter, and it had no autopilot or anything and so on, but still it was fairly modern and pretty efficient. And the whole business hasn't changed much.
Hmm.
These had 6 hours of fuel. They were actually... the American CH-46, which flew a lot in Vietnam, but when the Canadians got them, they added, instead of 2 hours fuel, they put 6 hours of fuel. The Army had a dozen of them, and they just had the two-hour fuel tanks, but we had 6 hours of fuel. In any event, there was only six of them across Canada, if you can imagine, for search and rescue.
Wow.
And Comox, by far, had the most work. I first went to PEI. I did, I think, two aircraft searches in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, when I was a search master, is the one, responsible for setting up the search and so on. We did the occasional marine rescue, but often things with ships where you go to, if they're in trouble, you just hoist somebody off and so on and so forth. And that was mainly it. So it was really relatively quiet. When I got transferred to Comox, which I did in 73, I arrived on the base. The next day I was gone to the Arctic on a crash. So it was totally different. We were always busy, always doing things, and on and on and on. In fact, I'll show it to you in a minute in this thing. Do you have your book?
Oh, I do.
You can turn to page 395, and it's quite a list of stuff. If you go through, it was the longest search and rescue operation.
Wow.
In one day, anyway. So I'll give you a background of what we were doing that day. What had happened?
Go ahead. Do you want to talk about
it? Well, it's pretty straightforward. It's what we did was we were on standby crews. There were actually four helicopter crews, which were two pilots, two flight engineers, and one pararescue. And the pararescue guys are kind of noble guys, and the rest of us were flying along for the ride. But during daylight hours, and we were at the base, we would be 15 minutes. We had to be airborne. But on the weekend, it was 2 hours, or at night, it was 2 hours. And I got a call about 4 or 5 in the morning of this Easter Sunday morning. It was kind of interesting because I went on standby at midnight on this Saturday night. And I'd been playing soccer over in Powell River. We had a tournament. So anyway, I came back on the ferry, and now I'm on standby. And I got a call about 5 o'clock in the morning. And there was a very serious, the winds were 75 knots, and that's 90 or so miles an hour. And so it's at 130 kilometers, I guess. And lots of ships were in trouble, and so on and so forth. And so off we went for the day, from people hoisted off sailboats to looking for people missing to taking a couple of young girls we had to rescue on an island. A tree had fallen on their heads and so on. So it was really an interesting day. But Comox was by far the busiest and most important. But it had one thing, because politics entered into it. Two helicopters in Comox, two were in Trenton, Ontario, and two were in Summerside, Prince Edward Island. And there was usually one in Overhaul in Ontario somewhere, so that meant there were only five for all of Canada for searching and rescue. So the other aircraft squadrons helped us searching for things. We were searching for lost aircraft, which was the main reason we were supposed to be there. But because nobody did the marine stuff, nobody did the air evacs for sick people, and the RCMP couldn't, we did them all. So it was very interesting. And I did it for about 10 years.
Did you do, like you mentioned, you went to Hawaii. Did you do a lot of international?
Well, on maritime, not on the helicopter, of course, but in Maritime Air Command, we would fly and go to various places. One thing they did was to go to Londonderry, which is in Ireland. And there was JAS course, which is Joint Anti-Submarine Surveillance course, and we'd go over there for 6 weeks or so. We would certainly fly. We did a lot of flying. When I was at the warfare school, the East Coast squadrons were more affected by NATO and so on because it was the Atlantic, and we did a lot of sub-Xs down in a terrible place in Bermuda, you know, and to the Azores, where the Azores, you don't know where the Azores are.
No.
They're Portuguese islands between, in the Atlantic. I would think they're 500 or 600 miles from Portugal, but they got them somehow, and so on and so forth. And the Argus actually did a lot of looking for submarines and monitoring Russian submarines on the East Coast. And the Russians didn't come down on the West Coast, really, hardly at all. So there was much less going on.
Was it mostly training, or were you doing a lot of operations?
Well, no, we were operations, but on the West Coast, in Maritime Air Command, there wasn't much going on. From the Russian point of view, they had fleets on the Pacific and in the Black Sea, Crimea, but their whole focus was more off Europe and so on. So there was one squadron, 407 squadron, on the West Coast, Maritime Air Command, and there were 404, 405, and 415 squadrons. There's three squadrons on the East Coast because of the activity in the Atlantic. So there wasn't much doing in the Pacific. And if you didn't mind boring through cloud a lot, it was okay.
How about operational or technical difficulties? Anything that's common?
We were short of airplanes. This is search and rescue. You have to understand that this was the third largest air force in World War II. After the war, it went down to a couple thousand people, and then things started to happen in the Cold War, and they just mushroomed in size. And when I joined the Air Force, I think there was 50-odd thousand. It's now down to about 20, I think. And, you know, so there was lots of things going on. I think you can understand the search and rescue operational thing. I mean, if an airplane crashes, nobody knows where we go and look for it.
Mm-hmm.
Much as that missing Boeing 777.
The Malaysian?
Yeah, the Malaysian. Yeah. Well, that would be a typical operation
okay.
if we were there
mm-hmm.
in search and rescue. And we'd be looking for it and so on and so forth. And trying to rescue people. And I didn't bother bringing any pictures of some of those crash sites and so on, but they're, you know,
that's
they're
okay.
pretty typical. But it was neat to do something worthwhile. As the Air Force, my time in the Air Force progressed, money became tighter, gas became more expensive. Today they don't, we used to do, well, when I was at the search and rescue squadron in Prince Edward Island, as I said, I think I was on 2 aircraft searches in 3 years. That was really
mm-hmm.
nothing. But every summer, the generals had a fishing camp in Labrador, a salmon
mm-hmm.
fishing camp. And our task for 6 weeks was to fly up to Goose Bay, which is in Labrador, which had an American base, and aircraft, large aircraft could land there. They would fly in ministers of the government, 6 Canadian general types, and 6 guests.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be there for 4 days. Salmon fishing, and they would smoke their salmon and all this down on the Eagle River. Well, we were responsible for flying them from Goose Bay into the 100 kilometers or so into the
oh.
fishing camp and being if anybody needed anything.
Mm.
And it was sort of neat, but that's I did that every summer. I was there at PEI, it was a big deal. We flew people in to go salmon fishing. Well, I don't know if you could get away with that today, you know.
Did you get any salmon out of it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Good.
Yeah. Atlantic salmon. So, I the promotion, I had put 22 years in the Air Force, and I had lost my category, minor thing, and I couldn't fly anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, and so I became a staff officer in plans in Victoria, and I decided that unless I could fly, I didn't want to stay in the Air Force, so I retired.
Oh, okay.
And I was lucky enough to retire. Let me think about this. I think I was 43, and I got a pension right away. Can you imagine? And it stayed the same until I was 60, and then it picked up all the inflation from the time, 1979 to 1995. I was born in 35. So, unification of the Canadian Forces. The only effect it had was the Navy had some pilots, the Army had some pilots,
mm-hmm.
and now they could go and get into the Air Force jobs, and some of them came in to fly, and it was none of us wanted to fly with the Navy, but they wanted to fly with the Air Force. That was the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of interesting watching the battle for, you know, the Air Force flying jobs. But that was the only difference. It was, the Army and Navy and Air Force were quite different, and you wouldn't have experienced any of it. Yeah, and we valued, we were much less rank conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And you could pretty well say what you wanted most of the time. And, you know, if somebody who was senior to you and you would say, look, that's not right. Well, you couldn't do that in the Navy and the Army and so on, but you could in the Air Force. And we valued the technicians a lot. So.
And you not as much in the Navy?
Well, I don't think they had the same contact. I mean, we went flying with flight engineers and these are all enlisted guys,
mm-hmm.
They were more our friends and so on, as opposed to being underlings or whatever. We were all on the same basis,
mm-hmm.
flying. So it was different and better, I think.
You think it was better to unify,
oh, yeah.
or the
no, no,
Air
better.
Force
I think
running
it was
better?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it was better. Yeah,
I see.
But they've pretty well gone back to the old way almost now. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, it's. The Canadian Air Force is now the Royal Canadian Air Force
mm-hmm.
again. They have a separate headquarters and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
And how much of your work consisted of training compared to?
Oh, probably at least 60% training.
Okay.
Yeah. It would, with the helicopter, we were always training. There was a lot of confined area work. That is to say, you had to go in areas where you, very small areas, it was. And so you had to practice that all the time, and so on and so forth. And Maritime Air Command, that, well, we did a lot of training, probably at least 50%, 60% okay. training, and so on.
Was a lack of recognition ever a concern?
No, we got recognized, you know, pictures and papers and stuff mm-hmm. on the TV. And you're pretty happy doing what you're doing, you know. So that didn't bother me, I don't think anyone else.
What about specific operations under NATO or NORAD?
NORAD was primarily the fighters and the CF-101s, the 101s. We only would look for anybody who bailed out and so on. And NATO was north, it was the Atlantic, you know, and I had no part in that, although some of the guys you will have spoken to or will be speaking to will be guys who are on Sabres in Europe. And we had, I think, 12 squadrons in Europe, and we don't have any anymore, I don't think. You know, I mean, that's how it's changed. And I had very little to do with NATO, just going to jazz course in London, Derry, Ireland.
Did you talk about your experiences very often, or was
Well, I belong to the Air Crew Association, and it's the Vancouver Island Air Crew Association, and it started out in Britain, and it was quite a it was under all the rules of order and so on, and you went to meetings and whatnot, and then you would have a speaker and have lunch, and before somebody speaking you had a beer together, and you know, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. But that the people are dying off, you know, mm-hmm. all the people that were associated with it. So, and we had something like several hundreds of members in the Vancouver Island one. And when I joined, it was 100 odd, and now we're down to 90. And we still have members in their 90s. In their age, we have 196. And I was a young one, and I'm still a young one, if you can imagine. Mm. And so it's slowly fading away. Other than that, that's meeting once a month. And I was the president for a couple of years, and people are less interested in taking up positions where you have to do stuff like that. So it's failing, or it's fading away.
Mm.
And then we have a walking group. There's a dozen of us, so we walk every week there, and we meet there, and we take turns each week deciding where to walk, where we're going to have lunch, and we talk a lot about, you know, what's going on. And then I generally go for lunch on a Thursday with a few people at the... I belong to the wardroom. Have you ever been to the wardroom?
I know.
You should... Well, you have to be a member to go, or with a member, but other than that, it's the officer's mess out here. It's quite a nice place.
Mm.
And when I have lunch, I had lunch there yesterday with a few people, and there was five of us only there. When I first had my lunch, and there were 12 or 15 there, but they died or whatever. And yesterday we were downstairs in the casual bar, because we come casually for this lunch, and there were four other people there. It could hold 100. There was 9 of us having lunch and having a drink.
Mm.
So something has to happen. They have built these buildings, and what they're going to do with them, it's a very large, a very nice, it's got 136 rooms for people to stay, you know, if you're on course.
Yeah.
It has a lovely dining room, lovely bar, on top of a hill, has a casual, lovely bar, and hardly anyone's there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just a sign of what's happening. So it'll be interesting to me to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, my research is on just Canadian maritime Air Force contributions. So your role in search and rescue, if you had to maybe summarize what you think.
Well, I think that everything's changed, you know. All your equipment, look at it. we had wire recorders when I... Anyway. I think it would be valuable if there was more exposure to military life when you were young, just to become aware of responsibilities and all that sort of thing. If Harry gets in, the first thing he'll be doing is going to basic training and learning to march. And the idea of learning to march and so on is when someone says left turn, you turn left, you don't turn right, or you know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's you're confined to barracks for 6 weeks, and then you can go on and on. So I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. How society would treat that today, I don't know. How about you? Would you like to be in an environment where you... your bed gets inspected every day, and you march, and you take courses of, and you must run, and so on and so forth. And you can't leave the base for 6 weeks, and then you are allowed to be the senior course, and you can slip out unannounced because you're the guy doing the bed checks and so on. Your bed check and so on. So it's it only lasts for about 12 weeks, and then you go through whatever course is flying, which are... they're still marching to some degree, but it's mainly involved in flying and courses and mm-hmm. aerodynamics and all that sort of stuff. So, but anyway, I think society's changed, and mm-hmm. I don't know if the fit is good for many young people. That's my question.
Yeah.
You were allowed a lot of latitude in the days when I was flying. If I wanted to take for example... I was playing when I was at Comox last time. I was on standby, but there's a soccer game, and I'd take the standby crew up to the soccer game, and I would play soccer,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd come back, and you could do things like that. If you wanted to go looking for glass floats, which are used in Japanese nets, I don't know if you're familiar with the various types of glass floats, but anyway. You could search for these things if you wanted up and down the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
Because you call it training. You could decide to take a trip to Whistler, perhaps. you could do all these things.
Yeah.
But it's much more regimented and much more... gas used to be cheap.
Mm.
It's not now.
Not anymore.
Yeah. So, and aircraft hours were easy to get. Summarize... flying, you can tell Harry is in flying large aircraft is 98% boring and 1% nerve-wracking and 1% you really got to pay attention. If he were to get on to fighters, I don't know if people who are young are going to ever be on fighters now because it's all the unmanned stuff that's built.
Mm.
But there'll be lots of pilots. There's lots of pilots need for airlines right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be, but it's, as I said, it's very routine, but it's a good job. And search and rescue was, I think, the best of the jobs because you did so many different things.
Mm.
So that was why I went there and enjoyed it.
How did your experience compare to what you expected when you just first wanted to enlist and fly?
Of course, I was made an observer, which which surprised me, and I actually if you don't like what you're doing, you can cease training. It's called CT, and I decided I want to be a pilot. And then I got so bored sitting around, I went back on the course and finished it and went through, and it worked out anyway. I got to do pilot training, as maybe a couple of hundred of us did, which was a big bonus,
mm-hmm.
which was neat. So.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think the whole experience impacted your life?
Well, it really impacted my life in that, as I said, I was from Vancouver. I had been to Washington State when I first flew to Victoria when I was 12 to play soccer. They rented an airplane to DAC an EC3 to fly over to play in a tournament. That was the only flying I had ever done. All of a sudden, I now traveled across to Ontario. When I was in school, I took Spanish. I learned French. I took Spanish and German. And you certainly get a larger feeling of Canada. It may not change your opinion of the way things are done and so on, but it certainly enlarges your life. It would certainly enlarge, pardon me for saying that, your life if you were to travel and get posted somewhere every 3 years or whatever it was.
Yeah,
and I think I was based in Comox twice. PEI, I was really there 3 times. I was in Halifax, I was in Rivers, I was in Grimley, Gimley, Portage-la-Prairie. These are all over 22 years, you know. And so you, one coast to the other, and staff school in Ontario and whatnot, and so on and so forth. So it's an enlarging experience, I think.
Did you have a favorite place where you were posted, or a favorite place where you did?
Well, Comox was by far the best place to be, and it's not because we get rainy winters, it's because it's a neat place to live. Campbell River, when did you leave Campbell River? A couple of years ago?
Yeah, 2010.
That's really a sort of a modern town now, I think.
It's growing.
It used to be a fishing village, sort of, and a pulp and paper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if that's open anymore.
No, it closed a few years ago.
Did it?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, Comox was good, and the island was good, and so on. When I retired, I bought a house in Tawasin, and met my present wife there 25, 20, 30 years ago, I guess. And she has one son from previous marriage, and I'm here because she has one child, I have four. But mine are in, it gives you an idea of the Air Force, Calgary, Quebec City, San Francisco, and one's in Tawasin.
They're all in the Air Force?
No, they're, now I'm giving you an idea of the Air Force life, how it,
oh, I see.
The influence,
what you mean.
Where they went, and so on. But her son is here, he's a cop with the Saanich. And so we bought a house, and we share a house together. And we've been here about 10 years now.
And what about internationally? Was there one particular operation or place that you went that stands out?
Well, I think the first trip to Hawaii, when you're sitting at a pool and it's at dusk and these girls are doing the hula and you're having a 10-cent beer, which is what it was at the U.S. Navy bases, and there's a Hawaiian girl with a, my first time I ever saw a charcoal barbecue, and you could get frog's legs and chickens and for 10 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I never had teriyaki before that, so it was neat.
Was there any significant differences in terms of your job when you were out in international waters or?
No, not really. No. We were pretty, you have to remember that we certainly had some radio communications, but once we were out 1,000 miles away or whatever it was, that was, you know, we were on our own all the time and operated pretty much on our own, except when we did cooperation exercises with the Navy. So it was fun.
Do you want to go through a cooperation exercise with the Navy?
Did I want to? I didn't mind. We didn't mind one way or the other. We, the Navy, I spent 2 years as staff officer here and staff officer plans. And it was interesting because they were so different, you know, so unrelaxed, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And just a different world.
To have a lot of, like when you were doing these practices with the Navy, did that have, how much of an impact if it did?
Just part of life, you know.
Oh, okay.
We accepted it. The Navy was the senior service and they liked to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
That was fine. And we did our thing and away we went.
What kind of things did you guys
practicing? There obviously was no war in the war. Well, the only thing that actually happened, I guess, was I arrived in to instruct at the OTU in 62 in PEI, and at that time, shortly thereafter, the missile crisis in Cuba, and we had to be on cruise, and the Neptunes actually were set up for atomic weapons. Well, there was none of it. We had depth charges and torpedoes to sink submarines, but we were measured for atomic weapons, and it was obvious that, you know, you wouldn't remember what happened in 62, 63 with Cuba.
Only through videos.
Yeah, well, you might have as good an idea as me, but we were then involved in maybe going to war. It was really quite serious. That was the most warlike thing, I think, that we're involved with.
Did you have an expectation of what your role would be if they did?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, we'd be flying exercises, chasing submarines. That was our job. So, 62-63, it was. 62-63. That's a long time ago.
Is there anything else you wanted to?
No, that's great. I just wanted to, I have a generally similar opinion to most.
Mm-hmm.
We enjoyed our time. We lived fairly well and enjoyed life.
That's good. Okay, I'm going to make a few concluding remarks. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Blair Wilkinson on March 14th, 2014. Thank you very much for the interview. And have we both signed the release form?
We both signed
the release
form. Oh, actually,
I have not signed the release form.
Well, there's one here.
But I will. We're passing that then. Okay.
I'll have one of your cookies, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, go ahead. Okay, yes, we have both signed the release form. And